Live from New York City, it's The Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. Today, we're going to talk about something that rarely gets attention, and that is censoring the progressive voices, those at the cutting edge, the Chris Hedges, Cornel West, and my guest for this hour, Abby Martin. We know about Facebook and Wikipedia and Google and YouTube now have policies that will exclude those that they do not support. So if you're on the wrong side of an issue, well, then you're persona non grata. What's it like being in that position? What happens if you write a really good article, investigative report, but there's no one's going to carry it? This has already happened to dozens and dozens of outstanding journalists. And now it's happened to my guest in studio, Abby Martin. Now, many of you know that Abby is one of our leading international voices among younger American journalists and media activists. She's the host of the investigative documentary news program, The Empire Files, on the Pan-Latin American network, Telsur, TV English, out of Caracas, Venezuela. Recently, U.S. sanctions against Venezuela has forced Telsur to stop broadcasting after having its wire cut. The Empire Files features hard-hitting investigative history and insights into subjects ignored by mainstream corporate media. Earlier, Abby was the host of Breaking the Set on the Russian Today Network. Abby is a founder of the organization Media Roots that supports citizen journalism and serves on the board of the Media Freedom Foundation, which manages Project Censored, which airs on the PRN network. And she's also co-directed the film 99%, the Occupy Wall Street collaboration. Older Empire Files episodes can be viewed at theempirefiles.tv and on YouTube. And her personal website is an accomplished visual artist is abbymartin.org. Nice to have you with us today, Abby.
Thank you for that incredible bio. Great to be on.
Abby, I want to discuss with you, please, the propaganda war between corporate and independent media and the rising epidemic of censorship of independent, particularly activist, online news and commentary sources. And that said, even today, I received from Craig Murray a little piece. I won't go through all of it, just the first couple paragraphs. It says, Facebook has deleted all of my posts from July 2017 to last week because I am apparently a Russian bot. For a while, I could not add any new post either, but we recently found a way around that, at least for now. To those of you tempted to say, so what? I would point out that over two-thirds of visitors to my website arrive via my postings of the articles to Facebook and Twitter. Social media outlets like this blog, which offer an alternative to MSM propaganda, are hugely at the mercy of these corporate gatekeepers. Facebook's plunge into censorship is completely open and admitted, as is the fact it operated for Facebook by the Atlantic Council, the extreme neocon group part funded by NATO and whose board includes serial war criminal Henry Kissinger, former CIA heads Michael Hayden and Michael Morrow, and George Bush's Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, among a whole list of horrors. The staff are worse than the board. Their lead expert on Russia bot detection is an obsessed nutter named Ben Nemo, whose fragile grip on reality has been completely broken by his elevation to the Internet's Witchfinder General. Nemo, gradually titled Senior Fellow for Information Defense at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Lab, is the go-to man for establishment rubbishing of citizen journalists. And as with Joseph McCarthy or Matthew Clark, one day society will sufficiently recover its balance for it to be generally acknowledged that this is the kind of witch hunt nonsense was not just an aberration, but a manifestation of the evil it claimed to fight. Now, it goes on from there, but let's pick it up from there, since now this is involving you. The epidemic of censorship that has gone into overdrive on large social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube, including the details of silencing Telesur in Venezuela. The forum is yours.
Yes, and I think that this requires a little bit of historical context, going back to the DNI report. This all kind of was ginned up during the lead-up to the election. And during the election, and of course afterward, we were facing a whole new wave of fake news and Russian propaganda and disinformation and kind of this giant combating of this, because the Democratic establishment cannot face reality about why they lost to a reality show billionaire clown. So starting with the DNI report, I mean, when this report came out, we were waiting with bated breath. We were thinking that this is going to be the end-all, be-all proof of Russian collusion. So I was alarmed, Gary, to see that my name and show from RT, Russia Today, was in the report as one of the reasons why Hillary lost the election. I mean, my show had ended 2 years before the election, but it said that it had fomented radical discontent. And that's the phrase that I want your viewers to hang on to, because we keep going back to this phrase, radical discontent, sowing discord. And when you look at what these tech companies are doing, working in concert with the government, it's not only to combat Russian trolls and disinformation, it's to limit and backpage the content that quote-unquote sows discord. And that is open for gross interpretation here. So when I saw the DNI report and I saw that it didn't actually include evidence of Russian collusion, but it in fact included a crude analysis of RT programming, I was frankly alarmed, especially when you're talking about my former show on there, which really just talked about police brutality, you know, covered third-party candidates. And then you realize that that really was the threat. That's the threat to sowing discord, covering Jill Stein, talking about inequality. I mean, as you notice, none of these politicians really acknowledge the fact that half of this country is living in poverty and half of the country doesn't have enough savings for an emergency. That's never discussed on the campaign trails of these politicians who are backed by, you know, millionaire, billionaire donors here. So since the election, then you saw, you know, media institutions, you basically saw the Senate committee late last year begging tech companies, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, to preemptively censor and backpage content, again, that, quote, sowed discord, prevent the foment of discord. That was late last year. And since then, I mean, we know what's happened. Under this banner of fighting fake news, you've seen Google. You know, meanwhile, mainstream media is talking about how Google is censoring on behalf of China. Well, Google already censored on behalf of the government here, without there even being a law. So Google late last year already backpaged all state media, Telesur, RT, Press TV, probably Al Jazeera too. But it wasn't just that. They didn't just stop there. When you realize what actually happened with this organization called Proper Not that was put out there by, you know, the purveyors of so-called real news, Washington Post and New York Times, that set the news for the Beltway, even though they are also the purveyors of fake news that have continued to get us into military intervention after military intervention and sell that bipartisan foreign policy consensus. Those were put out as, here's the fake news sites. Not only RT, not only these other, you know, disinformation sites, InfoWars, but Black Agenda Report, Counterpunch, Truth Dig. And then you saw those websites take an enormous hit in traffic. Then you saw Adpocalypse, the demonetization of YouTube. I mean, YouTube's owned by Google. And then when you get into Facebook, it gets very shocking. I mean, as you just mentioned, Craig Murray talking about his Facebook post being removed. Facebook is openly working not only with the Israeli government, they've already fulfilled 95% of Israeli requests to remove Palestinian pages that quote-unquote sow discord. Palestinians get the majority of their news from Facebook. So you're really putting the kibosh on a whole region of people trying to get real, honest reporting about what's going on to them, frankly. And then you have them working with the Atlantic Council. You mentioned this in the intro. The Atlantic Council is a who's who's of Iraq war architects and war criminals. Spooks and cops comprise of this think tank, military agencies, NATO, oil corporations, and defense contractors. So it becomes very murky when we're talking about free press and censorship, when literally these tech companies are working with government agencies and think tanks, but there's just kind of one barrier between them. So I guess they can say, hey, we're private companies, we can do whatever we want, you violated our terms of service. But it really is not that simple. They are really working with agencies stacked with CIA officials to determine who is fomenting radical discontent on Facebook. And we have seen what that has turned into. As everyone's kind of cheering the coordinated purge of Alex Jones, I frankly don't understand how he's more dangerous than, let's say, Fox News, who's ginning up hysteria against minorities and Muslims on a daily basis and selling the next military intervention that could kill another million people. However, when that coordinated purge happened and everyone was cheering it on, meanwhile, you had Facebook removing dozens of pages from left-wing organizers. You had the counter-protest rally to unite the right removed arbitrarily. They said because there was a photo of Fred Hampton being posted. I mean, that's the logic when you actually go down to the nitty-gritty of what is going on here. They're just randomly removing pages that actually are left-wing legitimate organizing efforts from grassroots activists, anti-fascist pages, Antifa. So they're not really giving any rhyme or reason behind this, but it seems very apparent to anyone who has been on the target or the crosshairs of this fake news mantra understands that this is a very slippery slope. And if we cheer on the censorship of, you know, taking down these pages, taking down someone like Alex Jones, the interpretation is up to the people who are running the establishment, who think that people who are on the radical left are too radical, are fomenting discontent, and should be taken offline. You know, we bought into the social media entities thinking that they were this egalitarian reflection of what the internet was supposed to be. We bought into Google. We thought that it wasn't going to be evil. We all bought in, right? We put our content up on YouTube, and now we put ourselves in a position where these tech giants are the purveyors of our reality. They are curating our reality because they don't think that we're smart enough to understand what's fake news and what's real news. They're giving us the content and spoon-feeding it to us. So Google's dead. Already, it's almost impossible to find real news on Google. You have to go through page 10 of search results to even find something beyond the mainstream narrative. Facebook's dead. You know, they're removing these pages en masse, and on top of that, you can't even actually access your page likes. And I can't even actually pay now to get content boosted because it says that it's too political, maybe because of my prior affiliation with RT. And we already know the shadow banning that's taking place on Twitter and beyond. So we're at a really dangerous crossroads here where we've put all of our faith and trust, and grassroots citizen journalists have put all of their content into these websites. And I'm seeing all over the place mainstream journalists calling to shut down Medium, calling to shut down WordPress. I saw someone else's whole database of body of work get shut down on WordPress without an explanation. So really, it's unbelievable. And then we want to get, I mean, we can get into Telesaur next. I feel like I just rambled off a lot about the tech stuff. But yeah, I mean, what's happening to Telesaur is just an unbelievable part of this wave of censorship, Gary.
I would add a few names, the ones you listed, Truthout and Truthdig, mm-hmm. Global Research, Consortium News. We found 121 sites that were now being algorithm censored, where they weren't told what you're producing by outstanding journalists is wrong. They simply went ahead and kept the people from being able to read the stories because they weren't getting up on the search engines. And as a result, they said upwards of 75% of their traffic was blocked. Now, for small organizations that maybe have one or two or three people running them, these are really mom-and-pop operations. They're highly credible. There's a great deal of veracity in what they're stating, and they're dying. They're withering and dying, and I'm concerned about that. You just mentioned what they were doing with the mainstream media. But go now into depth, please, about how the U.S. sanctions and forcing Telesaur to be inactive as part of a larger attempt to fuel regime change internally in Venezuela.
Absolutely. And just to add on to you, you know, it's a really good point, Gary, that as this is happening to someone like Alex Jones, he's a martyr in the mainstream. He's heralded as kind of this figurehead under this wave of censorship to, of course, justify the eradication and purge of all pages, right, that don't fall in line. The problem is someone like Alex Jones will have no problem picking up millions of viewers on his app. He already has a base of fanatical supporters that will follow him wherever he goes, and this will just further legitimize his efforts as this martyr. We don't have that. We don't have the ability to transfer over millions of people onto an app or, you know, generate some other mirrored content with all the things that we've done. We don't, as activists and grassroots journalists who are not funded by right-wing billionaires or corporations, we're left in the dust here. When it comes to Telesaur, this is coming off the heels. So I'm going to take you back now to the Bush administration. Back in 2002, the Bush administration was instrumental in a coup against Hugo Chavez, kidnapped him at the barrel of a gun, immediately put the kibosh on the Constitution, and wanted to privatize the oil. As part of that coup attempt backed by the U.S., shutting down Telesaur was also in the works. Now, fortunately, that coup actually fell flat. But I was surprised to learn that the Bush administration did not implement sanctions on Venezuela during his reign. It wasn't until the Obama administration in 2015 that Venezuela was deemed a unique national security threat randomly, which I thought was odd because it was completely out of the news and it poses no threat to the U.S. It could be because it has the largest oil reserves in the world. So at that time, I thought, huh, this is very strange. That's when the sanctions started, and that's when it started to become a little bit more difficult for Telesaur to function as a news entity. Now, Telesaur was created as a joint project from Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro to try to counter this corporate media narrative that was driving regime change in both of those countries and beyond. I mean, the pink tide in Latin America was really sparked by Hugo Chavez's election. And the U.S. obviously wants to reinstate hegemony in that region of the world. And they were very bothered by the fact that people like Evo Morales, Mujica, you know, all across the region were really resurging and generating independent candidates that were not falling in line to U.S. corporatism and militarism. So Telesaur was created as that, so it's always been a target of regime change efforts and a target of the U.S.-backed opposition on the ground in Venezuela. But it wasn't until the Trump administration that they really set their sights back on Latin America. Maybe during Bush and Obama administration they were too focused on destroying and destabilizing the Middle East, and Trump said, hold on, this region of the world really got away from us, and we know his contempt for obviously brown-skinned people, of course, of the Latin origin. So he definitely set his sights on Latin America, especially Venezuela. And as someone who's surrounded by hawks like Pompeo and John Bolton, I mean, John Bolton is constantly talking about Venezuela, when can we invade? A leaked document just came out that Trump was constantly saying, when can we invade, when can we invade? So this, the latest round of sanctions, and sanctions have been increasing steadily over Trump's administration, but the latest really, really crazy round of sanctions came in May, right after the re-election of President Maduro. He won by, you know, 5 million votes in a country of 20 million. And so the Trump administration punished the Venezuelan people for, you know, quote-unquote, selecting the wrong candidate that the U.S. didn't want them to. So what did we do? We slapped debilitating sanctions more so than any region since Nicaragua back in the 1980s when we were waging a full-blown bloody war against the Nicaraguan people. So that's how devastating these sanctions are on Venezuela today. And, of course, sanctions do exactly as they're intended to do. It's not just corrupt government officials. It's the poor and working class and most vulnerable people of these countries who now are denied access to food and medicine. So life-saving medication is now not getting in the hands of the people in Venezuela, more so because of these sanctions. But that's not all. The sanctions also completely seized up Telesaur's ability to transfer funds in and out of the country. And even though Telesaur is funded by five Latin American countries, all of these progressive countries that I just mentioned across the region, they have put the kibosh on the ability to transfer funds from those countries as well. So amazingly, Gary, all of this is just part and parcel of a larger operation that coincides with the Facebook thing, which I'm going to get into. So fast forward to a couple weeks ago where there was actually an assassination attempt against Nicolas Maduro. They attempted to blow him up on stage on live television with C4 explosives attached to drones. Now, the perpetrators were caught. It was actually traced back to Bogota, departing President Manuel Santos and Miami. There's a right-wing pundit named Haimy Bailey who's on TV saying, I was privy to a meeting in Miami where people were talking about how we're going to assassinate him. You have Manuel Santos telling a room full of U.S. business leaders, it's time for Maduro to be taken out. So when Trump and John Bolton say, oh, we have nothing to do with this, I don't buy it, especially since we know the regime change plots and narratives that have been ongoing since Hugo Chavez was elected and subsequently Maduro. So it's pretty obvious that that had something to do with what's going on. But just days after this assassination attempt, just days, I think three, Facebook arbitrarily took down two accounts, Telesur English and Venezuela Analysis. Now, Telesur English, of course, is one of the only outlets that's countering this regime change mantra against Venezuela and offering kind of an alternative perspective about what's going on in the region, of course, uplifting these voices of poor and working class people. That was arbitrarily shut down, but of course we know Telesur is affiliated with the state. And Telesur has been a target of these attacks for years. But Venezuela Analysis was also shut down arbitrarily, and Venezuela Analysis has no correlation with the state at all. It's just simply one of the other only outlets that is challenging this regime change narrative, trying to overthrow Maduro in Venezuela. So it is very suspect, Gary, that right after this assassination attempt, two of literally the only outlets that you can get an alternative perspective about what happened, why, and what is going on, and what's the context behind this, were shut down. Were completely shut down, and they were not reinstated until days later after this went through the news cycle, you know, so the mainstream media can put this foothold on the narrative that it was a false flag, that he did it to himself. Meanwhile, these pages are just offline. And this is on top of sensitive content bans already. You can't even go on Telesur's Twitter page without logging in and proving your age. There's sensitive content bans for all of their content. You can't actually watch our content on the ground in Venezuela without signing in and proving your age because it's all sensitive content. You can't watch a documentary that we made about socialism without signing into YouTube and proving that you're not a minor. It's very strange. So this has been happening. But it's escalating to a point where we've reached a point of no return. And just a really quick other context about how Telesur has been a target and what's going on with Telesur now. Back in 2015, another U.S.-backed coup plot that was thwarted was to bomb the Telesur headquarters in Caracas. When I was there on the ground last year with my partner, Mike Preisner, we were on the ground covering these Guarimba protesters. If we admitted that we were working with Telesur, we could have been killed in the streets. People were lynched. Afro-Venezuelans were killed, burned alive. After we left, one of our colleagues from Telesur was actually ambushed with bombs, guns, and shot in the back. So Telesur has always been a target. These sanctions, they weren't directly to shut down Telesur, but it's hard to say that that wasn't an intended consequence. You know, some big collateral damage that was a happy happenstance for the U.S. government to really effectively shut down not only my show, but Tariq Ali's show. Two shows that really continue to challenge these dominant narratives of just bipartisan foreign policy consensus, endless war, endless militarism, regime change around the world, and really discussing the role of the U.S. empire both in domestic and foreign policy issues.
Thank you for that overview. Also, have you noticed how frequently those on both the left and right use Venezuela as a failed socialist state when it didn't fail because of socialism? It thrived under Hugo Chavez because he was sharing the wealth of the oil with the people and setting up cooperatives and collectives and free education and helping millions out of poverty, dire poverty, that the previous administrations had not done a thing for. And the people are completely absent any logic when it comes to understanding what true socialism is. And yet all the countries in South and Central America that have been targeted, five in the last 10 years, all under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, were socialist countries, or at least very liberal countries with progressive leaders. And every one was a target for regime change, Honduras being the most obvious because they succeeded there. They succeeded in Libya. They almost succeeded in Syria. They succeeded in the Ukraine. And not once, not a single time on any, not on Rachel Maddow, not on any of the other stations, have I seen anyone held accountable for our intervening in other countries' democratically elected processes as being responsible for what is happening now. Could you address the contradiction? And if you want, give us an example of how Rachel Maddow covers this, the darling of the left, the corporate left, versus how you or others who are not a part of the corporate left establishment would cover the same story.
And thank you for saying that, Gary, because I'm so frustrated with leftists and just alternative media for not just defending the sovereignty of Venezuela. I don't care if you don't like Maduro. I don't care if you think they're corrupt. We need to defend the sovereignty of this country that's being attacked by the Trump administration, and that there's constant regime change efforts again. I mean, what's going on here? So, you know, a perfect example of what you're talking about here, of what everything that's wrong with the corporate media, you know, not only just the complete and utter uniformity and obedience to just these narratives, but even someone like Chris Hayes, another darling of the left who, you know, he makes a cool $30,000 a day to go up there and pretend like he cares about the people. He actually admitted on Twitter recently, I couldn't believe my eyes, someone asked him, why are you not covering climate change? Why is MSNBC ignoring this? These cataclysmic, you know, we're on the precipice of these cataclysmic climate catastrophes and the wildfires and these fire tornadoes. And he said this. He said, we've tried, and it's a palpable ratings killer. So what my question is, why is that a palpable ratings killer, but the suffering of Syrian children is not? Why is the suffering of Venezuelans not a palpable ratings killer? Why can you pick and choose what is a ratings killer and what's not when it comes to the serious issues that are affecting this country? Could it be the fact that the corporate media is subsidized by defense contractors and oil companies, Chris? I mean, it's just stunning to hear someone actually say that and throw that out there. Like, yeah, we would, but we won't get money, basically, is what he's saying. It's going to crash and burn our advertisers. So I think that's really the crux of this. And then you turn to someone like Rachel Maddow, for who throughout the entire last year, I think that she has not talked about anything but Russia and Putin, maybe 1% of the time. And that's actually an exaggeration. I mean, you look at some of these montages of her clips from her show, and it's Russia, 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 Putin, 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 Putin. How many Russians went to Davos? I mean, actually xenophobic mantras that are very, actually, frankly, racist against Russians. So that's where Rachel Maddow's head's at. And they, you know, every time, this is what the establishment does, and especially the Democratic Party, every time that there's a genuine movement, grassroots energy against someone like Trump, they want to channel that energy into something that they can garner and harness into Democratic votes. And they don't want it to come into some revolutionary spirit that can actually move policy to the left. So what's a perfect way to do that? Well, blame Russia and Putin for everything that's going on in this country. Inequality, African-Americans getting gunned down in the streets without accountability. That's Russia. So it's been actually a genius strategy, with or without, you know, people actually knowing that they're part of this larger operation, to harness the energy and filter into something that can just be a base of votes for Democrats. It's very cynical and insane. When it comes to Venezuela, you hit it right there. People want to, you know, I'm so sick of the right wing, too. The left wing, I'm very upset that they're not defending the sovereignty of Venezuela, but the right wing is just laughably cartoonish when that's literally all they can point to as, you want America to become like Venezuela. People are eating dogs and rats. I mean, they just believe anything they read, right? I was on the ground in Venezuela. I understand how big the lie is. I actually was confused before I went there because of just the inundation 24/7 of media propaganda telling me this is the way it is. So I was alarmed getting there, realizing how giant and massive the lie could be perpetrated by all corporate media journalists and people who are there, too. They see what I'm seeing. So I was shocked. Not only the fact that the government has an enormous amount of support. I mean, I talked about those 5 million people who voted for Maduro. There was massive amounts of pro-government rallies there, full of Afro-Indigenous, Afro-Venezuelan, Indigenous, poor working-class people from the actual barrios there. And then you go to the opposition rallies, which, of course, were equal in size, if not larger, affluent, more white. You can tell that they were a little bit more wealthy by the way that they wore clothes and jewelry. And so there is two sides of the story there. The problem is we're not hearing the other side of the story. We only hear one side of the story, and all the people online and that have the money and the opposition, those are the people that are only able to get their voice out. I mean, I spoke to poor people in the barrios there who said, foreign media doesn't tell the story of revolutionaries here. And you mentioned these kind of waves of revolution and counter-revolution that these countries have gone through. They've gone through cyclical processes of devastation, where before Hugo Chavez got in, there was a failed state. There was a collapsed economy. They were smashing ATMs in the street, and actually that government that had preceded Hugo Chavez had gunned down and massacred 3,000 people in one of the most egregious massacres in the region. So that's actually what invoked Hugo Chavez to run and to try to seize power. Was seeing the devastation that Venezuela was in. So these people who say, oh, we miss what Venezuela was, well, a lot of those people are speaking from the role of the rich landowner, wealthy oligarch class who lost power, and they desperately want that power back. And it's really unfortunate that people, you know, they don't even understand. They just look at Venezuela in a vacuum, and they say, oh, the government's insane and stupid, and they keep printing money, and the government understands what's going on. The people on the ground understand what's going on. They know very well the nature of the economic war. Just to give your viewers some reference, I mean, back in 1973, before the U.S. overthrew Salvador Allende, another very popular democratic ruler there, and installed Pinochet, of course, this horrible tyrant who underwent a reign of terror and death, Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State at the time, was invoking fake union organizing from the left. He was trying to push Salvador Allende from the left to make it seem like leftists were opposing him. Not only that, but they had implemented a strategy that was to, quote, make the economy scream. That's what they wanted to do in Chile. That's exactly what they're doing in Venezuela. So when you hear that there's a shortage of food and there's a starving nation, it's a very cynical talking point that's actually created. Anyone who's honest about Venezuela understands this very basic point. There's not a general shortage of food. There's a general shortage of food items. And that's basic items that Venezuelans use to make arepas and to make very basic things, oil, flour, toilet paper. For example, so things that actually are causing a very large crisis but are purposely withheld by the giant capitalist powers in that country. It's not a socialist nation, it's a mixed economy, and you have certain corporations that supply basic food items that are actually subsidized by the government in a program called CLAP, that they go and actually subsidize these food baskets that try to make up for the withholding of basic food items from the big capitalist powers. For example, a company like called Polar, which is run by a Trump-esque person who is instrumental in trying to overthrow Maduro. Well, he actually creates, Polar creates several items in the Venezuelan food basket, oil, flour, etc. So it becomes just a little bit more confusing when you realize that, hold on, this isn't just about food not existing. This is about certain items being withheld by corporate powers. And then when you actually look at who these protesters are, not the protests that I talked about where there's, you know, tens of thousands of people who are peacefully marching without any interference from the government. You look at the violent wing. And the same thing's happening in Nicaragua. Max Blumenthal has been doing excellent reporting on this. The same thing's going on there, where there's a violent wing that's kind of winked and nod by these opposition leaders and politicians, and they are just given free rein to terrorize the city. And those are the people who are just straight-up executing Sandinistas in Nicaragua. They're executing Chavistas in Venezuela. They're burning Afro-Venezuelans alive. They're targeting socialist enclaves of the state, whether it be nurseries, maternity wards, hospitals, food distribution warehouses. I mean, I was sitting there talking to a masked vigilante with a pinned grenade in his hand, shirtless, looked like he was on meth. And I was like, why are you holding a pinned grenade? What is going on here? And he said, I can't be an entrepreneur here. And I said, hold on. I thought you guys were a starving nation. I thought the government was gunning you down the street. You're telling me you're going to blow up a food distribution warehouse because you can't be an entrepreneur? So the narrative becomes very slippery once you're on the ground talking to these people. But the problem is, Gary, none of these corporate media anchors that like to glorify these protests, and, you know, we have John Oliver saying that all they're doing wrong is having Pupitkov cocktails and they're holding back, even though they caused half of the deaths in the streets. These people don't provide a space and a microphone for these protesters to say, what are you actually doing? Why are you killing people? What is going on here? And there's certainly no context to the economic war and the role of the U.S. in fomenting this complete destabilization and seizing of their economy.
about 2 weeks ago, I wrote a letter to Michael Moore. It's the second letter I've written in 2 years. The first letter was in 2016, where I've known Michael for 30 years, and I simply said, Michael, knowing all the things that Hillary Clinton has done against her base, African-Americans, people of color, Latinos, women, children, not only in the United States but around the world, what she says, what she does, and I listed them. I gave very specific ones that are all firmly detailed. I said, why would you want to praise her, do a film on her, and be behind her when you have Jill Stein and true progressives who would change things? He never answered. Now I just sent him a new one. And why? Because here, who really speaks for the left, the official left? Well, you have Michael Moore, you have Bill Maher, and you have the biggest voice out there historically has been the Clintons and Obama. And all I did was simply take the official historical record of the Clintons, because all my sources told me that when they were in power, it was she, Hillary, running the entire White House and domestic and foreign policy, but he was the nice, friendly face with the charm that oozed out and took credit for it, but it wasn't the reality. So anyhow, I simply said this in Michael's, my latest letter, which I'll send you a copy of, and I simply said, had you stuck with Ralph Nader, and had you not, you and Bill Maher, in a shameless display, actually trying to shame Nader by blindsiding him on his on Maher's show, getting down your knees, begging him to withdraw, and then when he didn't, then embarrassing him as the entire left did, accusing him of causing both Al Gore and John Kerry to lose the elections, which was simply not true. I said, imagine the state of the union today. First, here's what I've been able to document. And by the way, I had Ralph Nader on my show last night and went over these things, and they're accurate. We would not have to bail out Wall Street as we did back in 2008, because we wouldn't have allowed the financial industries to engage in predatory loans and also create a subprime crisis. So we would have saved that crisis. We wouldn't have had student debt and a return to the what had been banned in 1833, debtors' prisons, which are now fully functioning and have been privatized, because Nader wouldn't have allowed that. He would have also clamped down, as he originally did with credit card rules, he would have clamped down on people like payday loans. You wouldn't have had 80,000 SWAT team raids last year just to deliver, not to arrest people who are terrorists or kidnappings, but to hunt down people and give them their notices they've been sued. And you also wouldn't have had, you would have had public education free. You would have had universal health care under Medicare. You would have had gains to Social Security. You would have not had genetically modified foods protected under the DARC Act of Barack Obama. You would have had a challenge to GMOs. You would have had more sponsorship of decentralized farming, because Nader believes in decentralized farming. And he would have gone to the bully pulpit, even if Congress may not have supported him. But at least, even if he would have lost, and I voted for Nader several times, he would have lost creating a better platform for programs going forward. For example, closing down all the military bases overseas. That would have been Nader. Not favoring Israel over Palestine in the largest outdoor prison in the world, in apartheid there. That would have been Nader. He would not have supported NATO's encircling of Russia. He would not have postured against Russia or China. He would have also challenged corporations, of which there were at least 61,000 factories that left the United States, closed down, causing over 6 million of workers to go out of work and have to find other work, frequently out of their profession. He would not allow all these high-end visa people to come in working at very low labor to displace people who had gained seniority. He would have not seen the evisceration of the middle class. You'd have had a thriving middle class, as we did from 1945 to 75. You would have not seen a wink and a nod towards white-collar crime. You would have not seen a Wall Street creating a $66 trillion derivative bubble among five banks that are bailed in, so if they go broke, the derivative position of the bank becomes first in line, and they confiscate our money in their banks. Not under Nader, you wouldn't have. You wouldn't have seen 16 million children going to bed hungry. You wouldn't have seen 104 million Americans living at, below, or above the poverty level but don't have any money for more than about a week to survive. You wouldn't have seen 2.3 million Americans living on $2 a day. You wouldn't have seen 3 million American children going to school but having no home afterwards. You wouldn't have seen people deciding whether it's medicine or food, and you wouldn't have seen pharmaceutical industry charging up to 500,000% profit above the 30-day supply of a generic drug, averaging 5,000% markup. You wouldn't have seen this. And so those are some of the things you would not have seen had Nader been elected. Now, imagine we wouldn't be having basis in Saudi Arabia, which was one of the precipitating principles that caused challenged the cause of Osama bin Laden to gain al-Qaeda support and attack the United States. You wouldn't have seen Saudi Arabia be able to hide the important 28 pages that showed Bandar, the Saudi ambassador and the friend of the Bushes, be able to protect the financing of many of those Saudi operatives. You wouldn't have seen any of that. You wouldn't have seen the CIA and the FBI and the CIA in becoming a deep state and protecting some and punishing others. You wouldn't have seen it under Nader because Nader is a person of principle. Rocky Anderson and Jill Stein the same. So because of the lack of scholarship, the lack of authenticity in the research, the lack of understanding human nature, the very people that the left has claimed to be protecting, it is punished. They have not gotten better in the last 24 years, starting with the Clintons and coming up till today. So the people who would be championing against these people should have been Michael Moore and Bill Maher and others and Rachel Maddow. So that was the letter I sent to Michael Moore, and even on Pacifica, the privatization and profiteering of some $77 million, it is alleged from Democracy Now!'s privatization of what was a public R, the people of Pacifica. I'm the longest running show in Pacifica's history on a daily basis, 42 years every day. And you wouldn't have had that. But now no one touches and no one can complain against Democracy Now! You're not allowed to. You know, Amy Goodman, you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to criticize Michael Moore. You're not allowed to criticize Bill Maher. So I see more and more people now who were historically aligned with the left, in line with the Democratic Party, walking away, becoming independent. They've had enough. Your thoughts?
Oh, my God, there's so much there. I mean, first of all, I wanted to cry when you were talking because of what the world could be, Gary. I mean, it honestly is heartbreaking. And we're living in a world right now where Nader is still hated, but Bush is not. Bush is embraced now. Is that amazing? Isn't that incredible to you that Nader is still a pariah, but people have opened their arms to take Bush back? You have Olbermann, who I loved during the Bush administration. I mean, he was going harder than most with those daily, you know, takes. He went on The View and groveled to Meghan McCain and said, "I am sorry for criticizing your father and criticizing Bush. I want Bush back." Can you imagine? Can you imagine saying that as Keith Olbermann? I mean, you're talking about Michael Moore, and this was a really, really unbelievable moment when Michael Moore actually got down on his hands and knees and begged Ralph Nader. What an embarrassment that was. Because 4 years prior to that, he was campaigning for Nader. He said, "The lesser of two evils is still evil." I remember him at the podium. I mean, come on now. Just like you have that clip of Bernie Sanders saying why you should never acquiesce and capitulate to the Democratic Party, and now he's that sheepdog that Ralph Nader calls him, that sheepdog corralling legitimization for the Democratic Party to keep those leftists hanging on to hope that there's still a glimmer of hope to get that candidate. You know, and then you have right now, let's go to the most recent election. I mean, the fact that everyone wants to blame the left and Jill Stein voters. Can you imagine for actually Hillary losing? Why don't you look at the Democrats? If you look at these swing states and you actually go down to the votes, Democrats, a lot of them voted for Trump. I mean, up to 8% of Democrats in some of these swing states actually voted for Trump. So why is it that Jill Stein voters continue to be blamed in every goddamn election, and I am sick of it. I'm sick of the two-party dictatorship telling us, no, next time we'll eke the needle to the left. All we've seen is it going to the right. It's gone so far to the right that now here we are, 100 years after the New Deal, thinking that this is revolutionary, that Bernie Sanders is a revolutionary. He's just saying what FDR did 100 years ago, before we saw unions crushed, anarchists crushed. Socialism was illegal in this country for decades. People were killed, beaten, jailed. So, it's a little bit disheartening 100 years later to say, wow, we're really starting over again. And we're not only starting over again, but we're being told to vote, just buy in, keep buying into the Democrats. Next time, abortion rights are hanging in the balance. I mean, how many elections have we been told, looked in the eye by John Kerry or Al Gore or Barack Obama and said, your abortion rights are hanging in the balance? Well, guess what, guys? You allowed this to happen. You guys built the institution that gave us Trump. This neoliberal nightmare that we're living in is why we have Trump. And already, even before Trump got in office, and they're greenlighting his justice nominees now. All these federal judges that he's appointing around the country are being greenlit by Democrats as some part of a deal. I mean, this is unbelievable now. Where's the sit-ins? Where's the civil disobedience? Okay, abortion rights are hanging in the balance now. What are you guys going to do about it? Because we've done all we can. We've been marching in the streets. We've been rallying for people who are actually going to stand up for our rights. The Ralph Naders, the Jill Steins, the Dennis Kucinich's. Where are you guys? You're going to let all this happen. You just voted in a trillion-dollar defense budget for a so-called maniac who's the next Hitler. I mean, it is so unbelievable what is going on and the fact that they continue to manipulate the masses and say, no, next time you just have... And who's going to be at next time? Baked Alaska? I mean, you know, they're just going to look at Trump and say, well, you can't let him win again. They said this every time. It's going to be Ted Cruz next. It's always going to be, we're better than the other guy. You have to vote for us, and then we'll figure out the policies. I mean, I just saw David Cross, one of my favorite comedians, doing a bit the other day, and he said, I'm a member of the DSA. He said, but we have to, he said, I'm a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. He said, but we can't worry about that now. He said, we're in such a precarious, nightmarish, dystopian hellhole. He said, we need to just vote for the Democrats in 2018. He's like, and then after that election, he's like, then we can worry about DSA stuff. And it's like, what are you talking about? We're told this every single election. Next time it's going to be even worse than Trump. You think the system and this institution that we built for ourselves in this crazy electoral process of dog and pony show billionaire elections, you think that the next time it's going to be different, that someone's going to be better than Trump, and then we're finally going to give room to Green and third-party candidates? Hell no. It's going to keep getting worse, and they're going to keep doing this to us every time. So I think it's time to stand up and say no more. Let's not let them shame us into voting for our morality and voting for our heart, Gary. Eugene Debs said it best. He said, I'd rather vote for what I want and not get it than vote for what I don't want and get it.
And remember, they put Eugene Debs in prison because he read a letter, and that was it, and that's how fearful they were. My concern is that the left is now attacking real liberals, real progressives, that they're not. Nothing in their DNA shows that they care about everyone, and they rule through fear and mass manipulation. For example, any decent human being who has any moral compass and a sense of spiritual awareness would not sexually assault anyone or sexually intimidate people, and I support that. But what I'm curious about, maybe you could address this, is why is it that all the women who say they care about women and children didn't seem to care about Bill and Hillary Clinton did to the 500,000 plus, some say 620,000 dead Iraqi children because of their sanctions. Madeleine Albright went on 60 Minutes with Leslie Saul and said, we're okay with that. What about the Bosnian children? What about Libya, where it has the only open-air slave market in the world? I had a picture on my website of three men hung upside down by their ankles to be sold in a flea market, or in a slave market, and that's Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Not a word from the left, not a word from the women's movement. And why is it that Bill Clinton has been given a pass when there are 9 legitimate accusations of rape against him, and a lot more that wasn't rape but harassment? But that's okay. We don't see him shamed, and him thrown outside? Why do we have these double standards where we say we're for something, but then it's very specific and very political?
Tribalism, partisanship, xenophobia, and American exceptionalism are hell of a drugs. I mean, we're talking about a tribalistic society that rallies along the notion that we're the best country in the world, that we can do no wrong. When we commit evils and atrocities around the world, it's because we're moral, and that's our morality guiding this compass of this death machine. And we do things with good intentions. That's the Sam Harris argument. Look, I think that this is perfectly exemplified with just the latest migrant crisis, where all of a sudden Trump did exacerbate that crisis with the family separation thing, but it wasn't too much different than the Obama and Clinton policy of mass deportation, right? They just want to go back to humane mass deportation. So this is an amazing example of kind of this almost manufactured hysteria from the media, from the liberal, from liberals and from Democrats. It was amazing to me, Gary, because as someone who's an internationalist, just like you, and who feels absolutely viscerally sick when I understand that my tax dollars are paying for bombing children on a daily basis around the world, I felt like it was a little bit strange for everyone to suddenly pretend to care about separating families when our foreign policy literally separates families on a daily basis in every country that the military is in. So I think this is just a perfect example of we can't go back to the Democrats are not good enough. The Democrats are continuing this horrendous, horrific foreign policy, bombing seven predominantly Muslim countries, having special operations soldiers in 70% of the world's nations, having 800 military bases around the world with lily pads that the Pentagon can't even account for. Every base is doing untold damage to the culture, to the environment, to the society. And that's just on the surface level. I mean, the war games taking place. I mean, you could just go on and on and on. So this cognitive dissonance of having America first, this idea of we have national interests. There's no national interest. They're fighting wars on behalf of the richest oligarchs in this country for the 1%. The poor people in this country, they're not getting anything from devastating and wrecking the rest of the world. They're getting screwed, and because all of our resources are getting squandered by the military-industrial complex. So it's astounding to me, this cognitive dissonance. What is our foreign policy doing to separate families? What is our foreign policy doing to kill children? Why don't you care about that? Welcome to my world. I mean, geez, I feel like this is the crux of the issue. I talk to everyone, and I'm like, why don't you care? Why don't you care? And I think it just goes back to that sickness, the sickness of American society, that we are the empire babies. We're the children of the empire with this ego and arrogance. And I think that this really, when you look at the mass shooting phenomenon, when you look at the phenomenon that America has, it's the most dangerous industrialized country to give birth. America actually has an increase in the last 20 years of suicide, death by suicides. We have twice as many death by suicides than we do homicides in this country. How is that compared to the other countries in the world? It's actually going up. All the other countries are going down. What is the linkage of all these bizarre mass phenomenon that are just really disturbing and dystopic about American society? Could it be the fact that we are the children of the empire and we have this preordained notion that we're somehow supreme and better? And these people want to, you know, they don't only want to have death by suicide, but they want to have suicide/homicides where they take out dozens of people with them and get it on the news. I mean, there's something extremely sick about this individualistic, this neoliberal mantra where you can be rich, you can be famous. I mean, we're the celebrity-obsessed culture. That's why Trump is kind of the perfect manifestation of all the horrible traits of our society. Like, people want to pretend like he's an aberration. Oh, no, no, no. He is actually the perfect example of what America really is. He ripped that mask off. And that's why the establishment hates him so much. He has made empire way less palatable to sell around the world, not to mention here. So they like that Obama came in and placated everyone and made everyone fall asleep. I mean, that's why you see people who are Hillary supporters out there saying, you know, we could be at brunch right now if Trump wasn't in office. Well, really? Because I think Hillary would have probably had a no-fly zone in Syria within the first week. Do you know what that would have done? So yeah, I'm right there with you, Gary. I'm an internationalist through and through, and I'm just as sickened by the suffering of Syrian children as I am the suffering of Palestinian children, as I am the homeless kids right outside of my apartment. And I just don't understand how we can make people understand that we are in one global community, and the world continues to shrink. And as the climate crisis gets worse, the world is going to shrink even more. If people are devastated by this, and people are so cynically, they want to punch down to immigrants and refugees and migrants, not understanding that our policies are what is causing the refugee crisis or what is causing the immigration crisis. Go back to NAFTA. Go back to the dirty wars. You mentioned the coups in Honduras, El Salvador. I mean, this is what the crux of our policies are. And so what are we going to do when the climate crisis brings tens of millions of more refugees to our borders? We're in one world here, and we got to open our borders and open our arms, because things are going to just get worse from here unless we open our hearts more to humanity.
Those who have open hearts, let the love flow. Those who do not are not going to change. That's what I have seen. Just one final issue that has not been addressed, and I'll just a little caveat on what you said. Think of Saudi Arabia and how terrible that country is and its ruling family, an absolute monarchy, and the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, and Kuwait. Do you know that they all have something in common? They don't allow a single refugee into their country, not a single one. When was the last time you heard anyone on the left or right challenge that? Also, Japan doesn't allow a single refugee in. Doesn't matter where you're from, you don't get in. And we don't talk about the important issues. Also, we give the White Helmets an Academy Award for Best Short Documentary. They're on Democracy Now! Being promoted. Also, regime change is promoted on Democracy Now! In Syria and Libya. Why don't we hold people accountable when they're wrong, and when the consequence of being wrong is that people suffer and die? Instead, they're heralded as, oh, isn't this the great person? And I'm saying, how can you be great if your information and advice and your posturing and positioning has caused others in this world who have nothing to have even less, including their own lives?
I'm right there with you. I've been vehemently critical of Democracy Now! Lately. I am stunned. They just had a guest on that was actually talking about that Saudi bus bombing of those children, and their guest said, well, what were the children doing? Straight up human shield propaganda parroted from the IDF. I mean, I couldn't believe my eyes. And yeah, it's time that we hold these even grassroots institutions accountable, because again, people put all of their faith into, you know, Pacifica and Democracy Now, and we have to call out when regime change is being parroted, and we have to counter these narratives wherever they are. And absolutely, that includes Democracy Now. It includes everyone. And we can't just let people off the hook because they're, quote unquote, on our political side of the aisle. Because lives are at stake, Gary, as you mentioned. And we know that there are several countries still on the radar, Iran, Venezuela. I mean, the list goes on and on. We have to protect the sovereignty of these countries. And instead of saying, well, I was right, I was on record saying Saddam was evil. I was on record calling Assad a war criminal. I was on record talking about how Maduro was corrupt. It's like, what's more important? Being on the right side of history, protecting the sovereignty and the fate and the democratic processes of people to have their own destiny and will to live? Or is it more important for you to be on the record as an unbiased journalist talking about how these countries are very complex and they're really corrupt and, yeah, there needs to be regime change, but maybe we shouldn't do it? It's like, let's just stand up here and say no. So I'm right there with you, and I'm really disappointed by, again, especially when it comes to Venezuela, how little people are really calling and calling out Trump for being a participant in this.
Abby, thank you for being on today. I really appreciate it, and all the best, and we'll continue to provide a forum for you whenever you need it to share your thoughts and insights.
Thank you so much, and check out our fundraising for Empire Files on MediaRoots.org. It's an article on there that can tell you how to donate. And also, I have a radio show on Media Roots Radio. Thank you so much, Gary. You're the best.
Okay. Abby Martin. I'm Gary Noe. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
I never knew.